an omnivorous student who gave as much serious thought to the running lore of the Navajo, the Kalahari Bushmen, and the marathon monks of Mount Hiei as he did to aerobic levels, lactate thresholds, and the optimal recruitment of all three types of muscle twitch fiber, not two, as most runners believe. Arnulfo wasn't going up against a fast American. He was about to race the world's only 21st century Tarahumara. While the shopkeeper and I were busy setting the over-under, I saw Arnulfo strolling past. I grabbed a couple of popsicles to pay him back for the sweet limes he'd given me at his house, and together we went looking for a shady spot to relax. I saw Manuel Luna sitting under a tree, but he looked so alone and lost in thought, I didn't think we should disturb him. Barefoot Monkey, however, saw it differently. "Manuel!" Barefoot Ted shouted from across the street. Manuel's head jerked up. "Amigo, am I glad to see you," Barefoot Ted said. He'd been looking around for some tire rubber so he could make his own pair of Tarahumara sandals, but figured he needed some expert advice. He grabbed mystified Manuel by the arm and led him into a tiny shop. As it turned out, Ted was right. All tire rubber is not the same. What Ted wanted, Manuel demonstrated with his hands, was a strip with a groove right down the middle, so the knot for the toe strap can be countersunk and not get torn off by the ground. Minutes later, Barefoot Ted and Manuel Luna were outside with their heads together, tracing Ted's feet and slicing away at the tire tread with my big-bladed Victorinox knife. They worked through the afternoon, trimming and measuring, until, just before dinner, Ted was able to do a test run down the street in his new pair of Air Lunas. From then on, he and Manuel Luna were inseparable. They arrived for dinner together and hunted around the packed restaurant for a place to sit. Urique has only one restaurant, but when it's run by Mama Tita, one is plenty. From daybreak till midnight for four straight days, this cheerful 60-something woman kept the four burners on her old propane stove blazing full blast, bustling away in a kitchen hot as a boiler room as she turned out mountains of food for all Caballo's runners. Stewed chicken and goat, batter-fried river fish, grilled beef, refried beans and guacamole, and minty, tangy salsas, all garnished with sweet limes and chili oil and fresh cilantro. For breakfast, she served eggs scrambled with goat cheese and sweet peppers, and on the side, heaping bowls of pinole and flapjacks that tasted so much like pound cake, I volunteered to apprentice in her kitchen one morning to learn the secret recipe. Footnote: Tita's secret. It's okay. She won't mind. She whips boiled rice, overripe bananas, a little cornmeal, and fresh goat milk into her batter. Perfection. As the American and Tarahumara runners squeezed around the two long tables in Tita's back garden, Caballo banged on a beer bottle and stood up. I thought he was going to deliver our final race instructions, but he had something else on his mind. "There's something wrong with you people," he began. "Rarámuri don't like Mexicans. Mexicans don't like Americans. Americans don't like anybody. But you're all here. And you keep doing things you're not supposed to. I've seen Rarámuri helping Chabochis cross the river. I've watched Mexicans treat Rarámuri like great champions. Look at these gringos, treating people with respect. Normal Mexicans and Americans and Rarámuri don't act this way." Over in the corner, Ted thought he could help Manuel by translating Caballo's clumsy Spanish into clumsier Spanglish. As Ted yammered, a faint smile kept flitting across Manuel's face. Finally, it just stayed there. "What are you doing here?" Caballo went on. "You have corn to plant. You have families to take care of. You gringos, you know it can be dangerous down here. No one has to tell the Rarámuri about the danger. One of my friends lost someone he loved, someone who could have been the next great Rarámuri champion. He's suffering, but he's a true friend. So he's here." Everyone got quiet. Barefoot Ted laid a hand on Manuel's back. Of all the Tarahumara he could have asked for help with his huaraches, I realized, He hadn't picked Manuel Luna by accident. I thought this race would be a disaster, because I thought you'd be too sensible to come. Caballo scanned the garden, found Ted in the corner, and locked eyes with him. You Americans are supposed to be greedy and selfish. But then I see you acting with a good heart, acting out of love, doing good things for no reason. You know who does things for no good reason? Caballo! The shout went up. Yeah, right. Crazy people. Mas locos. But one thing about crazy people, they see things other people don't. The government is putting in roads, destroying a lot of our trails. Sometimes Mother Nature wins and wipes them out with floods and rock slides. But you never know. You never know if we'll get a chance like this again. Tomorrow will be one of the greatest races of all time. And you know who's going to see it? Only crazy people. Only you, Mas Locos. Mas Locos! Beers were shoved in the air, bottles were clinking. Caballo Blanco, lone wanderer of the High Sierras, had finally come out of the wild to find himself surrounded by friends. After years of disappointments, he was 12 hours from seeing his dream come true. Tomorrow, you'll see what crazy people see. The gun fires at daybreak because we've got a lot of running to do. Caballo! Viva Caballo! Chapter 31. Often I visualize a quicker, like almost a ghost runner, ahead of me with a quicker stride. Gabe Jennings, 2000 U.S. Olympic trial, 1500-meter winner. By 5 a.m., Mama Tita had pancakes and papayas and hot pinole on the table. For their pre-race meal, Arnulfo and Silvino had requested pozole, a rich beef broth with tomatoes and fat corn kernels, and Tita, chirpy as a bird despite only getting 3 hours of sleep, whipped it right up. Silvino had changed into a special race outfit, a gorgeous turquoise blouse and a white sapete skirt embroidered with flowers along the hem. Guapo, Caballo said admiringly. Looking good. Silvino ducked his head bashfully. Caballo paced the garden, sipping coffee and fretting. He'd heard that some farmers were planning a cattle drive on one of the trails, so he tossed awake all night, planning last-minute detours. When he got up and trudged down for breakfast, he discovered that Luis Escobar's dad had already ridden to the rescue with old Bob, Caballo's fellow wandering gringo from Batopilas. They'd come across the vaqueros the evening before while shooting photos in the backcountry and warned them off the course. Now, without a stampede to sweat over, Caballo was searching for something else. He didn't have to look far. "Where are the kids?" he asked. Shrugs. "I better go get them," he said. "I don't want them killing themselves without breakfast again." When Caballo and I stepped outside, I was stunned to find the entire town there to greet us. While we'd been inside having breakfast, garlands of fresh flowers and paper streamers had been strung across the street, and a mariachi band in dress sombreros and torero suits had begun strumming a few warm-up tunes. Women and children were already dancing in the street, while the mayor was aiming a shotgun at the sky, practicing how he could fire it without shredding the streamers. I checked my watch and suddenly found it hard to breathe. 30 minutes till the start. The 35-mile hike to Urique had, as Caballo predicted, chewed me up and crapped me out. And in half an hour, I had to do it all over again and go 15 miles farther. Caballo had laid out a diabolical course. We'd be climbing and descending 6,500 feet in 50 miles, exactly the altitude gain of the first half of the Leadville Trail 100. Caballo was no fan of the Leadville race directors, but when it came to choosing terrain, he was just as pitiless. Caballo and I climbed the hill to the little hotel. Jen and Billy were still in their room, arguing over whether Billy needed to carry an extra water bottle, which, it turned out, he couldn't find anyway. I had a spare I was using to store espresso, so I hustled to my room, dumped the coffee, and tossed it to Billy. "Now eat something and hustle up," Caballo scolded. The mayor is going to blast that thing at 7 sharp. Caballo and I grabbed our gear. A hydration backpack loaded with gels and power bars for me, a water bottle and tiny bag of pinole for Caballo, and we headed back down the hill. 15 minutes to go. We rounded the corner toward Tita's restaurant and found the street party had grown into a mini Mardi Gras. Luis and Ted were twirling old women and fending off Luis's dad, who kept cutting in. Scott and Bob Francis were clapping and singing along as best they could with the mariachis. The Urique Tarahumara had set up their own percussion brigade, beating time on the sidewalk with their palilla sticks. Caballo was delighted. He pushed into the throng and began a Muhammad Ali shuffle, bobbing and weaving and punching his fists in the air. The crowd roared. Mama Tita blew him kisses. "Andale! We're going to dance all day!" Caballo shouted through his cupped hands. "But only if nobody dies! Take care out there!" He turned to the mariachis and dragged a finger across his throat. "Kill the music. Showtime." Caballo and the mayor began corralling dancers off the street and waving runners to the starting line. We crowded together, forming into a crazy human quilt of mismatched faces, bodies, and costumes. The Urique Tarahumara were in their shorts and running shoes, still carrying their palillas. Scott stripped off his shirt. Arnulfo and Silvino, dressed in the bright blouses they'd brought especially for the race, squeezed in beside Scott. The deer hunters weren't letting the deer out of their sight for a second. By unspoken agreement, we all picked an invisible line in the cracked asphalt and towed it. My chest felt tight. Eric worked his way over beside me. "Look, I got some bad news," he said. "You're not going to win. No matter what you do, you're going to be out there all day. So you might as well just relax, take your time, and enjoy it. Keep this in mind. If it feels like work, you're working too hard." "Then I'll catch 'em napping," I croaked, "and make my move." "No moves," Eric warned, not even wanting the thought to creep into my skull as a joke. "It could hit 100 degrees out there. Your job is to make it home on your own 2 feet." Mama Tita walked from runner to runner, her eyes puddling as she pressed our hands. "Ten cuidado, cariño," she urged. "Be careful, dearie."
10. 9.
The mayor was leading the crowd in the countdown.
8. 7.
"Where are the kids?" Caballo yelled. I looked around. Jen and Billy were nowhere in sight. "Get him to hold off," I shouted back. Caballo shook his head. He turned away and got into race-ready position. He'd waited years and risked his life for this moment. He wasn't postponing it for anyone.
"Brujita!"
The soldiers were pointing behind us. Jen and Billy came sprinting down the hill as the crowd hit,
"Cuatro!"
Billy wore surf baggies and no shirt, while Jen had on black compression shorts and a black jog bra, her hair knotted in 2 tight pippy braids. Distracted by her military fan club, Jen whipped the drop bag with her food and spare socks to the wrong side of the street, startling spectators, who hopped over it as it flew between their legs and disappeared. I raced over, snagged it, and got it to the aid table just as the mayor jerked the trigger.
Boom!
Scott leaped and screamed. Jen howled. Caballo hooted. The Tarahumara just ran. The Urique team shot off in a pack, disappearing down the dirt road into the pre-dawn shadows. Caballo had warned us that the Tarahumara would go out hard, but whoa! This was just ferocious. Scott fell in behind them, with Arnulfo and Silvino tucked in on his heels. I jogged slowly, letting the pack flow past until I was in last place. It would be great to have some companionship, but at this point, I felt safer alone. The worst mistake I could make would be getting lulled into someone else's race. The first 2 miles were a flat ramble out of town and along the dirt road to the river. The Urique Tarahumara hit the water first, but instead of charging straight into the shallow 50-yard crossing, they suddenly stopped and began rooting around the shore, flipping over rocks. What the hell? wondered Bob Francis, who'd gone ahead with Luis's dad to take photos from the far side of the river. He watched as the Urique Tarahumara pulled out plastic shopping bags they'd stashed under rocks the night before. Tucking their palillas under their arms, they slipped their feet into the bags, pulled them tight by the handles, and began sloshing across the river, demonstrating what happens when new technology replaces something that has worked fine for 10,000 years. Afraid of getting their precious Salvation Army running shoes wet, the Urique Tarahumara were hobbling along in homemade waders. "Jesus," Bob murmured. "I've never seen anything like it." The Urique Tarahumara were still stumbling over slippery rocks when Scott hit the riverbank. He splashed straight into the water, Arnulfo and Silvino hard behind. The Urique Tarahumara reached shore, kicked the bags off their feet, and stuffed them into their shorts to use again later. They began scrambling up the steep sand dune with Scott closing fast, sand spraying from his churning feet. By the time the Urique Tarahumara hit the dirt trail leading up the mountain, Scott and the two Quimares had made contact. Jen, meanwhile, was already having a problem. She, Billy, and Luis had crossed the river side by side with a pack of Tarahumara, but as Jen tore up the sand dune, her right hand was bugging her. Ultra runners rely on handhelds, water bottles with straps that wrap around your hand for easy carrying. Jen had given Billy one of her two handhelds, then rigged a second for herself with athletic tape and a spring water bottle. As she fought her way up the dune, her homemade handheld felt sticky and awkward. It was a tiny hassle, but it was a hassle she'd have to deal with every minute of the next 8 hours. So should she keep it? Or should she once again risk running into the canyons with only a dozen swallows in her hand? Jen began gnawing through the tape. Her only hope of competing with the Tarahumara she knew was to go for broke. If she gambled and crashed, fine. But if she lost the race of a lifetime because she'd played it safe, she'd always regret it. Jen tossed the bottle and immediately felt better. Bolder, even. And that led to her next risky decision. They were at the bottom of the first meat grinder, a steep 3-mile hill with little shade. Once the sun came up, she had little hope of sticking with the heat-eating Tarahumara. "Ah, fuck it," Jen thought. "I'm just going to go now while it's cool." Within 5 strides, she was pulling away from the pack. "Later, dudes," she called over her shoulder. The Tarahumara immediately gave chase. The two canny old vets, Sebastiano and Herbolisto, boxed Jen in from the front, while the three other Tarahumara surrounded her on the sides. Jen looked for a gap, then burst loose and pulled away. Instantly, the Tarahumara swarmed and bottled her back up. The Tarahumara may be peace-loving people at home, but when it came to racing, it was bare knuckles all the way. "I hate to say it, but Jen is going to blow up," Luis told Billy as they watched Jen dart ahead for the third time. They were only 3 miles into a 50-mile race, and she was already going toe-to-toe with a 5-man Tarahumara chase pack. You don't run like that if you want to finish. "Somehow she always pulls it off," Billy said. "Not on this course," Luis said. "Not against these guys." Thanks to the genius of Caballo's planning, we'd all get to witness the battle in real time. Caballo had laid out his course in a Y pattern, with the starting line dead in the middle. That way, the villagers would see the race several times as it doubled back and forth, and the racers would always know how far they were trailing the leaders. That Y formation also provided another unexpected benefit. At that very moment, it was giving Caballo plenty of reason to be very suspicious of the Urique Tarahumara. Caballo was about 1/4 mile back, so he had a perfect view of Scott and the deer hunters as they closed the gap with the Urique Tarahumara on the hill across the river. When he saw them heading back toward him after the first turnaround, Caballo was astounded. In the space of just 4 miles, the Urique crew had opened up a 4-minute lead. They'd not only dropped the two best Tarahumara racers of their generation, but also the greatest climber in the history of Western ultra running. "No way in hell," growled Caballo, who was running in a pack of his own with Barefoot Ted, Eric, and Manuel Luna. When they got to the 5-mile turnaround in the tiny Tarahumara settlement of Guadalupe Coronado, Caballo and Manuel started asking the Tarahumara spectators some questions. It didn't take them long to find out what was going on. The Urique Tarahumara were taking side trails and shaving the course. Rather than fury, Caballo felt a pang of pity. The Urique Tarahumara had lost their old way of running, he realized, and their confidence along with it. They weren't running people anymore. They were just guys trying desperately to keep up with the living shadows of their former selves. Caballo forgave them as a friend, but not as a race director. He put out the word. The Urique Tarahumara were disqualified. I got a shock of my own when I hit the river. I'd been concentrating so much on watching my footing in the dark and reviewing my mental checklist, bend those knees, bird steps, leave no trace, that when I started to wade through the knee-deep water, it suddenly hit me. I'd just run 2 miles, and it felt like nothing. Better than nothing. I felt light and loose, even more springy and energized than I had before the start.
Way to go, Oso!
Bob Francis was calling from the opposite bank.
Little bitty hill ahead. Nothing to worry about.
I scrambled out of the water and up the sand dune, growing more hopeful with every step. Sure, I still had 48 more miles, but the way it was going, I might be able to steal the first dozen or so before I had to make any real effort. I started climbing the dirt trail just as the sun was slanting over the top of the canyon. Instantly, everything lit up. The glittering river, the shimmering green forest, the coral snake coiled at my feet. I yelped and leaped off the trail, sliding down the steep slope and grabbing at scrub brush to stop my fall. I could see the snake above me, silent and curled, ready to strike. If I climbed back up, I risked a fatal bite. If I climbed down toward the river, I could plunge off the side of the cliff. The only way out was to maneuver sideways, working my way from one scrub brush handhold to the next. The first clump held, then the next. When I'd made it 10 feet away, I cautiously hauled myself back onto the trail. The snake was still blocking the trail, and for good reason. It was dead. Someone had already snapped its back with a stick. I wiped the dirt out of my eyes and checked the damage. Rock rash down both shins, thorns in my hands, heart pounding through my chest. I pulled the thorns with my teeth, then cleaned my gashes, more or less, with a squirt from my water bottle. Time to get going. I didn't want anyone to come across me bleeding and panicky over a rotting snake. The sun got stronger the higher I climbed, but after the early morning chill, it was more exhilarating than exhausting. I kept thinking about Eric's advice. If it feels like work, you're working too hard. So I decided to get outside my head and stop obsessing about my stride. I began drinking in the view of canyon around me, watching the sun turn the top of the foothill across the river to gold. Pretty soon, I realized, I'd be nearly as high as that peak. Moments later, Scott burst around a bend in the trail. He flashed me a grin and a thumbs up, then vanished. Arnulfo and Silvino were right behind him, their blouses rippling like sails as they flew past. I must be close to the 5-mile turnaround, I realized. I climbed around the next curve, and there it was, Guadalupe Coronado. It was little more than a whitewashed schoolhouse, a few small homes, and a tiny shop selling warm sodas and dusty packs of cookies, but even from a mile away, I could already hear cheers and drumbeats. A pack of runners was just pulling out of Guadalupe and setting off in pursuit of Scott and the Quimares. Leading them, all by herself, was the Brujita. The second Jen saw her chance, she pounced. On the hike over from Batopilas, she'd noticed that the Tarahumara run downhill the same way they run up, with a controlled, steady flow. Jen, on the other hand, loves to pound the descents. "It's the only strength I've got," she says, "so I milk it for all I'm worth." So instead of exhausting herself by dueling with Herbolisto, she decided to let him set the pace for the climb. As soon as they reached the turnaround and started the long downhill, she broke out of the chase pack and began speeding off. This time, the Tarahumara let her go. She pulled so far ahead that by the time she hit the next uphill, a rocky single track climbing to the second branch of the Y at mile 15, Herbolisto and the pack couldn't get close enough to swarm her. Jen was feeling so confident that when she reached the turnaround, she stopped to take a breather and refill her bottle. Her luck with water so far had been fabulous. Caballo had asked Urique villagers to fan out through the canyons with jugs of purified water, and it seemed that every time Jen took her last swallow, she came across another volunteer. She was still gurgling her full bottle when Herbolisto, Sebastiano, and the rest of the chase pack finally caught her. They spun around without stopping, and Jen let them go. Once she was rewatered, she began pounding down the hill. Within 2 miles, she'd once again reeled them in and left them behind. She began mentally scanning the course ahead to calculate how long she could keep pulling away. Let's see. Upcoming was 2 miles of descent, then 4 flat miles back into the village, then wham! Jen landed face down on the rocks, bouncing and sliding on her chest before coming to a stunned stop. She lay there, blinded with pain. Her kneecap felt broken, and an arm was smeared with blood. Before she could gather herself to try getting to her feet, Herbolisto and the chase pack came storming down the trail. One by one, they hurdled Jen and disappeared, never looking back. They're thinking, that's what you get for not knowing how to run on the rocks, Jen thought. Well, they've got a point. Gingerly, she pulled herself to her feet to assess the damage. Her shins looked like pizza, but her kneecap was only bruised, and the blood she thought was pouring from her hand turned out to be chocolatey goo from an exploded power gel packet she'd stashed in her handheld. Jen walked a few cautious steps, then jogged, and felt better than she expected. She felt so good, in fact, that by the time she reached the bottom of the hill, she'd caught and passed every one of the Tarahumara who jumped over her.
Brujita!
The crowd in Urique went crazy when Jen came racing back through the village, bloody but smiling as she hit the 20-mile mark. She paused at the aid station to dig a fresh goo out of her drop bag while a deliriously happy Mamatita dabbed at Jen's gory shins with her apron and kept shouting,
¡Cuarto! ¡Estás en cuarto lugar!
I'm a what? A room? Jen was halfway out of town again before her rickety Spanish let her figure out what Mama Tita was talking about. She was in fourth place. Only Scott, Arnulfo, and Silvino were still ahead of her, and she was nibbling steadily at their lead. Caballo had picked her spirit name perfectly. 12 years after Leadville, the Bruja was back with a vengeance. But only if she could handle the heat. The temperature was nearing 100 degrees just as Jen was entering the furnace, the jagged up-and-down climb to the Los Alisos settlement. The trail hugged a sheer rock wall that plunged and soared and plunged again, gaining and losing some 3,000 feet. Any of the hills in the Los Alisos stretch would rank among the hardest Jen had ever seen, and there were at least half a dozen of them, strung one behind the other. The heat shimmering off the rocks felt as if it were blistering her skin, but she had to stick tight to the canyon wall to avoid slipping off the edge and into the gorge below. Jen had just reached the top of one of the hills when she suddenly had to leap against the wall. Arnulfo and Silvino were blazing toward her, running shoulder to shoulder. The deer hunters had taken everyone by surprise. We'd expected the Tarahumara to haunt Scott's heels all day, and then try to blast past him at the finish. But instead, the deer hunters had pulled a fast one and jumped out first. Jen pressed her back against the hot rock to let them pass. Before she had time to wonder where Scott was, she was leaping back against the wall again. Scott is running up this goddamn thing with the most intensity I've ever seen in a human being, Jen said later. He's booking, going, ha, 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 ha. I'm wondering if he's even going to acknowledge me, he's so in the zone. Then he looks up and starts screaming,
Yeah! Brujita! Woo!
Scott stopped to brief Jen on the trail ahead and let her know where to expect water drops. Then he quizzed her about Arnulfo and Silvino. How far ahead were they? How did they look? Jen figured they were maybe 3 minutes out and pushing hard. Good, Scott nodded. He swatted her on the back and shot off. Jen watched him go and noticed he was running on the very edge of the trail and sticking tight to the turns. That was an old Marshall Ulrich trick. It made it harder for the guy in the lead to glance back and see you sneak up from behind. Scott hadn't been surprised by Arnulfo's big move after all. The deer was hunting the hunters. Just beat the course, I told myself. No one else. Just the course. Before I tackled the climb to Los Alisos, I stopped to get myself under control. I ducked my head in the river and held it there, hoping the water would cool me off and the oxygen debt would snap me back to reality. I just hit the halfway point, and it had only taken me about 4 hours. 4 hours for a hard trail marathon in desert heat. I was so far ahead of schedule, I'd started getting competitive. How hard can it be to pick off Barefoot Ted? He's got to be hurting on those stones. And Porfirio looked like he was struggling. Luckily, the head dunking worked. The reason I was feeling so much stronger today than I had on the long haul over from Batopilas, I realized, was because I was running like the Kalahari Bushmen. I wasn't trying to overtake the antelope. I was just keeping it in sight. What had killed me during the Batopilas hike was keeping pace with Caballo and company. So far today, I'd only competed against the race course, not the racers. Before I got too ambitious, it was time to try another Bushman tactic and give myself a systems check. When I did, I noticed I was in rougher shape than I'd thought. I was thirsty, hungry, and down to just half a bottle of water. I hadn't taken a leak in over an hour, which wasn't a good sign considering all the water I'd been drinking. If I didn't rehydrate soon and get some calories down my neck, I'd be in serious trouble in the roller coaster of hills ahead. As I started sloshing the 50 yards across the river, I filled the bladder of my empty hydration pack with river water and dropped in a few iodine pills. I'd give that a half hour to purify while I washed down a Pro-Bar, a chewy raw food blend of rolled oats, raisins, dates, and brown rice syrup, with the last of my clean water. Good thing I did. "Brace yourself," Eric called as we passed each other on the far side of the river. "It's a lot rougher up there than you remember." The hills were so tough, Eric admitted, that he'd been on the verge of dropping out himself. A bad news burst like that could come across as a punch in the gut, but Eric believes the worst thing you can give a runner mid-race is false hope. What causes you to tense up is the unexpected, but as long as you know what you're in for, you can relax and chip away at the job. Eric hadn't exaggerated. For over an hour, I climbed up and down the foothills, convinced I was lost and on the way to disappearing into the wilderness. There was only one trail, and I was on it, but where the hell was the little grapefruit orchard at Los Alisos? It was only supposed to be 4 miles from the river, but I felt as if I'd covered 10 and I still couldn't see it. Finally, when my thighs were burning and twitching so badly I thought I was going to collapse, I spotted a cluster of grapefruit trees on a hill ahead. I made it to the top and dropped down next to a group of the Urique Tarahumara. They'd heard they were disqualified and decided to cool off in the shade before walking back to the village. "No hay problema," one of them said. "It's not a problem." I was too tired to keep going anyway. He handed me an old tin cup. I scooped into the communal pinole pot, Giardia be damned. It was cool and deliciously grainy, like a popcorn slushy. I gulped down a cupful, then another, as I looked back at the trail I just covered. Far below, the river was faint as fading sidewalk chalk. I couldn't believe I'd run here from there, or that I was about to do it again. "It's unbelievable!" Caballo gasped. He was slick with sweat and bug-eyed with excitement. As he struggled to catch his breath, he sluiced sweat off his dripping chest and flung it past me, the shower of droplets sparkling in the blazing Mexican sun. "We've got a world-class event going on," Caballo panted, "out here in the middle of nowhere." By the 42-mile mark, Silvino and Arnulfo were still ahead of Scott, while Jen was creeping up behind all three. On her second pass through Urique, Jen had dropped into a chair to drink a Coke, but Mama Tita grabbed her under the arms and hauled her to her feet. "Puedes, cariño, puedes," Tita cried. "You can do it, sweetie." "I'm not dropping out," Jen tried to protest. I just need a drink. But Tita's hands were in Jen's back, pushing her back into the street. Just in time, too. Herbolisto and Sebastiano had taken advantage of the flat road into town to move back within a quarter mile of Jen, while Billy Bonehead had broken free of Luis to move within a quarter mile of them. This is anybody's day, Caballo said. He was trailing the leaders by about a half hour, and it was driving him batty. Not because he was losing, because he was in danger of missing the finish. The suspense was so unbearable, Caballo finally decided to drop out of his own race and cut back to Urique to see if he could get there in time for the final showdown. I watched him run off, desperate to follow. I was so tired, I couldn't find my way to the skinny cable bridge over the river and somehow ended up under it, forcing me to splash through the river for the fourth time. My soaked feet felt too heavy to lift as I shuffled through the sand on the far side. I'd been out here all day, and now I was at the bottom of that same endless alpine climb I'd almost fallen off this morning when I'd gotten spooked by the dead snake. There was no way I'd get down before sunset, so this time I'd be stumbling back in the dark. I dropped my head and started trudging. When I looked up again, Tarahumara kids were all around me. I closed my eyes, then opened them again. The kids were still there. I was so glad they weren't a hallucination, I was almost weepy. Where they'd come from and why they'd chosen to tag along with me, I had no idea. Together, we made our way higher and higher up the hill. After we'd gone about half a mile, they darted up a nearly invisible side trail and waved for me to follow. I can't, I told them regretfully. They shrugged and ran off into the brush. Gracias, I rasped, missing them already. I kept pushing up the hill, shambling along at a trot that couldn't have been faster than a walk. When I hit a short plateau, the kids were sitting there, waiting. So that's how the Urique Tarahumara were able to break open such big leads. The kids hopped up and ran alongside me until, once again, they vanished into the brush. A half mile later, they popped out again. This was turning into a nightmare. I kept running and running, but nothing changed. The hills stretched on forever, and everywhere I looked, children of the corn appeared. What would Caballo do? I wondered. He was always getting himself into hopeless predicaments out here in the canyons, and he always found a way to run his way out. He'd start with easy, I told myself, because if that's all you get, that's not so bad. Then he'd work on light. He'd make it effortless, like he didn't care how high the hill is or how far he had got to go.
Also!
Heading toward me was Barefoot Ted, and he looked frantic. Some boys gave me some water, and it felt so cold I figured I'd use it to cool down, Barefoot Ted said. So I'm squirting myself all over, spraying it around. I had trouble following Barefoot Ted's story because his voice was fading in and out like a badly tuned radio. My blood sugars were so low, I realized, I was on the verge of bonking. And then I'm going, crap, oh crap, I'm out of water. From what I could make out from Barefoot Ted's yammering, it was maybe a mile to the turnaround. I listened impatiently, desperate to push on to the aid station so I could chow down an energy bar and take a break before tackling the final 5 miles. So I tell myself, if I've got to pee, I'd better pee into one of these bottles in case I'm down to the last, you know. The last of the last. So I pee into this bottle, and it's like orange. It's not looking good, and it's hot. I think people were watching me pee in my bottle and thinking, wow, these gringos are really tough. Wait, I said, starting to understand. You're not drinking piss. It was the worst tasting urine I've ever tasted in my entire life. You could bottle this stuff and sell it to bring people back from the dead. I know you can drink urine, but not if it's been heated and shaken in your kidneys for 40 miles. It was a failed experiment. I wouldn't drink that urine if it was the last liquid on planet Earth. Here, I said, offering the last of my water. I had no idea why he hadn't just gone back to the aid station and refilled if he was so worried, but I was too exhausted to ask any more questions. Barefoot Ted dumped his whiz, refilled his bottle, and padded off. Odd as he was, there was no denying his resourcefulness and determination. He was less than 5 miles from finishing a 50-mile race in his rubber toe slippers, and he'd been willing to drink bodily waste to get there. Only after I arrived at the Guadalupe turnaround did it finally penetrate my woozy mind why Barefoot was dry in the first place. All the water was gone. All the people, too. Everyone in the village had trooped into Urique for the post-race party, closing up the little shop and leaving no one behind to point out the wells. I slumped down on a rock. My head was reeling, and my mouth was too cottony to let me chew food. Even if I managed to choke down a few bites, I was way too dehydrated to make the hour-long run to the finish. The only way to get back to Urique was on foot, but I was too wasted to walk. "So much for compassion," I muttered to myself. "I give something away, and what do I get? Screwed." As I sat, defeated, my heavy breathing from the hard climb slowed enough for me to become aware of another sound, a weird warbling whistle that seemed to be getting closer. I pulled myself up for a look, and there, heading up this lost hill, was old Bob Francis. "Hey, amigo," Bob called, fishing two cans of mango juice out of his shoulder bag and shaking them over his head. "Thought you could use a drink." I was stunned. Old Bob had hiked 5 miles of hard trails in 95-degree heat to bring me juice. But then I remembered. A few days before, Bob had admired the knife I'd lent Barefoot Ted to make his sandals. It was a memento from expeditions in Africa, but Bob had been so kind to all of us that I had to give it to him. Maybe Bob's miracle delivery was just a lucky coincidence, but as I gulped the juice and got ready to run to the finish, I couldn't help feeling that the last piece of the Tarahumara puzzle had just snapped into place. Caballo and Tita were jammed into the crowd at the finish line, craning their necks for the first glimpse of the leaders. Caballo pulled an old, broken-strapped Timex out of his pocket and checked the time. 6 hours. That was probably way too fast, but there was a chance that, "Vienen!" someone shouted. "They're coming!" Caballo's head jerked up. He squinted down the straight road, peering through the bobbing heads of dancers. False alarm. Just a cloud of dust and... No, there it was. Bouncing dark hair and a crimson blouse. Arnulfo still had the lead. Silvino was in second, but Scott was closing fast. With a mile to go, Scott ran Silvino down. But instead of blowing past, Scott slapped him on the back. "Come on!" Scott shouted, waving for Silvino to come with him. Startled, Silvino reached deep and managed to match Scott stride for stride. Together, they bore down on Arnulfo. Screams and cheers drowned out the mariachi band as the three runners made their last push toward the finish. Silvino faltered, surged again, but couldn't hold Scott's pace. Scott drove on. He'd been in this spot before, and he'd always found something left. Arnulfo glanced back and saw the man who'd beaten the best in the world coming after him with everything he had. Arnulfo blazed through the heart of Urique, the screams building as he got closer and closer to the tape. When he snapped it, Tita was in tears. The crowd had already swallowed Arnulfo by the time Scott crossed the line in second. Caballo rushed over to congratulate him, but Scott pushed past him without a word. Scott wasn't used to losing, especially not to some no-name guy in a pickup race in the middle of nowhere. This had never happened to him before, but he knew what to do about it. Scott walked up to Arnulfo and bowed. The crowd went crazy. Tita rushed over to hug Caballo and found him wiping his eyes. In the midst of this pandemonium, Silvino struggled across the finish line, followed by Erbolisto and Sebastiano. And Jen? Her decision to win or die trying had finally caught up with her. By the time she arrived at Guadalupe, Jen was ready to faint. She slumped down against a tree and dropped her dizzy head between her knees. A group of Tarahumara clustered around, trying to encourage Jen back to her feet. She lifted her head and mimed drinking. "Agua?" she asked. "Agua purificada?" Someone shoved a warm Coke into her hand. Even better, she said, and smiled wearily. She was still sipping the soda when a shout went up. Sebastiano and Arbolisto were running into the village. Jen lost sight of them when the crowd thronged around to offer congratulations and pinole. Then Arbolisto was standing over her, stretching out his hand. With the other, he pointed toward the trail. Was she coming? Jen shook her head. Not yet, she said. Arbolisto started to run, then stopped and walked back. He put out his hand again. Jen smiled and waved him off. Get going already. Arbolisto waved goodbye. Soon after he disappeared down the trail, the shouting began again. Someone relayed Jen the information. The wolf was coming. Bonehead! Jen saved him a long sip of her Coke and pulled herself to her feet while he downed it. For all the times they'd paced each other and all the sunset runs they'd done on Virginia Beach, they'd never actually finished a race side by side. Ready? Billy said. You're toast, dude. Together, they flew down the long hill and thundered across the swaying bridge. They came into Urique whooping and hollering, redeeming themselves magnificently. Despite Jen's bloody legs and Billy's narcoleptic approach to pre-race prep, they'd beaten all but four of the Tarahumara, as well as Luis and Eric, two highly experienced ultra-runners. Manuel Luna had dropped out halfway. Though he'd done his best to come through for Caballo, the ache of his son's death left him too leaden to compete. But while he couldn't get his heart into the racing, he was fully committed to one of the racers. Manuel prowled up and down the road, watching for Barefoot Ted. Soon he was joined by Arnulfo and Scott, and Jen and Billy. Something odd began to happen. As the runners got slower, the cheers got wilder. Every time a racer struggled across the finish, Luis and Porfirio, Eric and Barefoot Ted, they immediately turned around and began calling home the runners still out there. From high on the hill, I could see the twinkle of the red and green lights strung above the road to Urique. The sun had set, leaving me running through that silvery gray dusk of the deep canyons, a moonlight glow that lingers, unchanging, until you feel everything is frozen in time except you. And then, from out of those milky shadows, emerged the lone wanderer of the high Sierras. Want some company? Caballo said. Love it. Together, we clattered across the swaying bridge, the cool air off the river making me feel oddly weightless. When we hit the last stretch into town, trumpets began blasting. Side by side, stride for stride, Caballo and I ran into Urique. I don't know if I actually crossed a finish line. All I saw was a pigtailed blur as Jen came flying out of the crowd, knocking me, staggering. Eric caught me before I hit the ground and pushed a cold bottle of water against the back of my neck. Arnulfo and Scott, their eyes already bloodshot, pushed a beer into each of my hands. You were amazing, Scott said. Yeah, I said, amazingly slow. It had taken me over 12 hours, meaning that Scott and Arnulfo could have run the course all over again and still beaten me. That's what I'm saying, Scott insisted. I've been there, man. I've been there a lot. It takes more guts than going fast. I limped over toward Caballo, who was sprawled under a tree as the party raged around him. Soon he'd get to his feet and give a wonderful speech in his wacky Spanish. He'd bring forward Bob Francis, who'd walk back into town just in time to present Scott with a ceremonial Tarahumara belt and Arnulfo with a pocket knife of his own. Caballo would hand out prize money and get choked up when the party kids, who could barely pay for the bus back to El Paso, immediately gave their cash to the Tarahumara runners who'd finished behind them. Caballo would roar with laughter as Arbolisto and Luis danced the robot. But that would all come later. For now, Caballo was content to just sit alone under a tree, smiling and sipping a beer, watching his dream play out before his eyes. Chapter 32. That head of his has been occupied with contemporary society's insoluble problems for so long, and he is still battling on with his good-heartedness and boundless energy. His efforts have not been in vain, but he will probably not live to see them come to fruition. Theo van Gogh, 1889.
"You've got to hear this," Barefoot Ted said, grabbing my arm. Damn, he caught me just as I was trying to slink away from the madness of the street party and limp off to the hotel to collapse. I'd already heard Barefoot Ted's entire post-race commentary, including his observation that human urine is both nutrient-rich and an effective tooth whitener, and I couldn't imagine anything he could possibly say that would be more compelling than a deep sleep in a soft bed. But it wasn't Ted telling stories this time. It was Caballo. Barefoot Ted pulled me back into Mama Tita's garden, where Caballo was holding Scott and Billy and a few of the others spellbound. "You ever wake up in an emergency room," Caballo was saying, "and wondered whether you wanted to wake up at all?" With that, he launched into the story I'd been waiting nearly 2 years to hear. It didn't take me long to grasp why he'd chosen that moment. At dawn, we'd all be scattering and heading home. Caballo didn't want us to forget what we shared, so for the first time, he was revealing who he was. He was born Michael Randall Hickman, son of a Marine Corps gunnery sergeant whose postings moved the family up and down the West Coast. As a skinny loner who constantly had to defend himself in new schools, young Mike's first priority every time they moved was to find the nearest police athletic league and sign up for boxing lessons. Brawny kids would smirk and pound their gloves together as they watched the geek with the silky hippie hair gangle his way into the ring. But their grins died as soon as that long left arm began snapping jabs into their eyes. Mike Hickman was a sensitive kid who hated hurting people, but that didn't stop him from getting really good at it. "The guys I liked best were the big, muscular ones, 'cause they'd keep coming after me," he recalled. "But the first time I ever knocked out a guy, I cried. For a long time after that, I didn't knock out anybody." After high school, Mike went off to Humboldt State to study Eastern religions and Native American history. To pay tuition, he began fighting in backroom smokers, billing himself as the Gypsy Cowboy. Because he was fearless about walking into gyms that rarely saw a white face, much less a vegetarian white face spouting off about universal harmony and wheatgrass juice, the cowboy soon had all the action he could handle. Small-time Mexican promoters loved to pull him aside and whisper deals in his ear. "Oye, compa," they'd say. "Listen up, my friend. We're going to start a chisme, a little whisper, that you're a top amateur from back east. The gringos are going to love it, man. Every gabacho in the house is going to bet their kids on you." The gypsy cowboy shrugged. "Fine by me. Just dance around so you don't get slaughtered till the fourth," they'd warn him, or the third or the seventh, whichever round the fix had been set for. The cowboy could hold his own against gigantic black heavyweights by dodging and clinching up until it was time for him to hit the canvas. But against the speedy Latino middleweights, he had to fight for his life. "Man, sometimes they had to haul my bleeding butt out of there," he'd say. But even after leaving school, he stuck with it. "I just wandered the country fighting, taking dives, winning some, losing but really winning others, mostly putting on good shows and learning how to fight and not get hurt." After a few years of scrapping along in the fight game's underworld, the cowboy took his winnings and flew to Maui. There he turned his back on the resorts and headed east toward the damp, dark side of the island and the hidden shrines of Hana. He was looking for a purpose for his life. Instead, he found Smitty, a hermit who lived in a hidden cave. Smitty led Mike to a cave of his own, then began guiding him to Maui's hidden sacred sites. "Smitty is the guy who first got me into running," Caballo told us. Sometimes they'd set out in the middle of the night to run the 20 miles up the Kaupo Trail to the House of the Sun at the top of 10,000-foot Mount Haleakala. They'd sit quietly as the first rays of morning sparkled on the Pacific,
then run back down again, fueled only by wild papayas they'd knocked from the trees. Gradually, the backroom brawler named Mike Hickman disappeared. In his place arose Micah True, a name inspired by the courageous and fearless spirit of the Old Testament prophet Micah and the loyalty of an old mutt called True Dog. "I don't always live up to True Dog's example," Kabaya would say, "but it's something to shoot for." During one of his vision-seeking runs through the rainforest, the newly reborn Micah True met a beautiful young woman from Seattle who was visiting on vacation. They couldn't have been more different. Melinda was a psychology grad student and the daughter of a wealthy investment banker, while Micah was, quite literally, a caveman. But they fell in love. After a year in the wilderness, Micah decided it was time to return to the world. Wham! The gypsy cowboy knocked out his third opponent, and his fourth, and his fifth. With Melinda in his corner and those rainforest runs powering his legs, Micah was virtually untouchable. He could dance and shuffle until the other fighter's arms felt like cement. Once his fists drooped, Micah would dart in and hammer him to the canvas. "I was inspired by love, man," Micah said. He and Melinda settled in Boulder, Colorado, where he could run the mountain trails and get bouts in Denver arenas. "He sure didn't look like a fighter," Don Tobin, then the Rocky Mountain lightweight kickboxing champion, later told me. "He had real long hair and was carrying this crusty old pair of gloves like they were handed down from Rocky Graziano." Don Tobin became the cowboy's friend and occasional sparring partner, and to this day he marvels at the cowboy's work ethic. He was doing unbelievable training on his own. For his 30th birthday, he went out and ran 30 miles. 30 miles. Few American marathoners were putting up those numbers. By the time his unbeaten streak reached 12-0, the cowboy's reputation was formidable enough to land him on the cover of Denver's weekly newspaper, Westword. Under the headline Fist City was a full-page photo of Micah, bare-chested and sweaty, fists cocked and hair swinging, his eyes in the same glower I saw 20 years later when I surprised him in Creel. "I'll fight anybody for the right amount of money," the cowboy was quoted as saying. Anybody, huh? That article fell into the hands of an ESPN kickboxing promoter who quickly tracked down the cowboy and made an offer. Even though Micah was a boxer, not a kickboxer, she was willing to put him in the ring for a nationally televised bout against Larry Shepard, America's fourth-ranked light heavyweight. Micah loved the publicity and the big payday, but smelled a rat. Just a few months before, he had been a homeless hippie meditating on a mountaintop. Now they were pitting him against a martial artist who could break cinder blocks with his head. "It was all a big joke to them, man," Micah says. "I was this long-haired hippie they wanted to shove into the ring for laughs." What happened next summarizes Caballo's entire life story. The easiest choices he ever had to make were the ones between prudence and pride. When the bell clanged on ESPN's Super Fight Night, the gypsy cowboy abandoned his usual canny strategy of dodging and dancing. Instead, he sprinted self-righteously across the ring and battered Shepard with a furious barrage of lefts and rights. "He didn't know what I was doing, so he covered up in the corner to figure it out," Micah would recall. Micah cocked his right arm for a haymaker, but got a better idea. "I kicked him in the face so hard, I broke my toe," Micah says, "and his nose. Ding, ding, ding." Micah's arm was jerked into the air while a doctor began probing Shepard's eyes to make sure his retinas were still attached. Another KO for the gypsy cowboy. He couldn't wait to get back home to celebrate with Melinda. But Melinda, he discovered, had a knockout of her own to deliver. And long before that conversation was over, long before she'd finished telling him about the affair and her plans to leave him for another man and move back to Seattle, Micah's brain was buzzing with questions. Not for her, for him. He'd just smashed a man's face on national TV. And why? To be great in someone else's eyes? To be a performer whose achievements were only measured by someone else's affection? He wasn't stupid. He could connect the dots between the nervous boy with the great Santini dad and the lonely, love-hungry drifter he'd become. Was he a great fighter?